Automotive expert John Paul takes your car questions. It's summer road trip season, and hopefully all your journeys will be smooth and trouble-free. No tire trouble, overheating engines, or squabbling in the back seat. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we probably can't help you with that squabbling, but we will have expert advice on car maintenance. AAA car doctor John Paul is here to diagnose your automotive issues. He can also offer some guidance on buying or selling a car. And we'll discuss some of the automotive world stories in the news, from how the trade tariffs will affect car prices to the latest on autonomous cars and more. What are your car, truck, or SUV questions? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is good weather for a drive, but summertime driving also brings with it some challenges, from tourist traffic to overheating. On today's program, we will get automotive advice for the season and talk about some of the latest news from the world of cars, trucks, and SUVs. In the studio with me, John Paul. He's AAA Northeast's car doctor, with 30 years of experience in the automobile industry, and he's an ASE-certified master technician. Unfortunately, John Paul's regular partner in crime here on Maine Calling, J. Paige Deaton, had an unexpected little curveball this morning and can't be here today. And yes, she is fine. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you been following the progress of autonomous vehicles? Are you looking for advice on buying a new or used car? Are you planning a big road trip and want to know what to do for your car first? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. So nice to see you in person, John. Welcome back.
Well, it's great to be here. It's great to be here in person, too. It was a good drive up to Maine.
How was traffic on a Friday afternoon in the summer?
Well, once I got to New Hampshire, it was fine. Massachusetts was where the real problems were, but other than that, it was fine. It was a good drive. There's a lot of people on the road, and I think a lot of people may have decided to take today off. So
it spread out a little bit more. Well,
so.
I always start the program by asking you what you've been driving, and for those of you who haven't heard this Maine Calling program before, some lucky people who write about the automotive industry are in a pool. What's the name of the pool?
Well, I belong to a group called the New England Motor Press Association. In fact, I'm the actual president of the New England Motor Press Association.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, and what happens is vehicle manufacturers have cars available to automotive press people to try them out, evaluate them, see what we think of them, and hopefully write about them
and live with them for a while, don't just drive them on an afternoon, but take them home.
You know, I've always said you don't know what a car is really like until you go to the supermarket with it. You know, see if the grocery bags are going to fall over in it. You know, those kind of things. You know, take it to the home improvement store. You know, all the things you would normally do with a car. You try to speed it up a little bit, and even to the point where I will get in and out of the back seat to see how comfortable it is. I'm also a child passenger safety technician and instructor. So if it's a car that I think is going to be a family-style car, I'll put a car seat in it to see how it fits, see how the ease of installation is. So I really try to, you know, get an overall feel for the car. And that's one of the things to do. And, you know, and every once in a while, you get something really fun to drive. But most of the time, they're just typical cars.
So this would be incentive for any young person who really loves cars to think about being a member of the automotive press.
Well, that's one thing to do. People have come to me before and said, you know, how did you get into this and what did you do? And my background was I was an auto mechanic, automotive technician before I came to work at AAA. So this is something that's sort of slowly evolved over time. And I started to write about cars. And it was one of those things that you know, I still don't call myself a writer, but I guess I can't really get away with that if I've been doing it for 30 years. So
given that, and now hearing how it is that you come to get to drive a different vehicle every week, what have you been driving lately and what do you really like?
Well, I've been, it's kind of funny. I've been doing a little bit of back-to-back sort of thing, and it's not by design. But a couple of weeks ago, I drove the Lexus NX 300, which is a small sport utility vehicle, but it's a luxurious small sport utility vehicle that has kind of a sporty profile to it. And just this week, I'm driving the new Acura RDX, which is sort of, if you're not familiar with an Acura RDX, think of a Honda CR-V trimmed out in Acura trim, so kind of plushy and a little bit more luxurious. And both of those vehicles, they've really tried to make them more sedan-like, which is kind of funny because, you know, vehicle manufacturers like Ford are saying we're not going to sell sedans anymore. But they try to make them more car-like, and so the handling's better, the ride's better, but it still has that utility of an SUV and the ability to, you know, handle the worst weather because typically, at least here in the Northeast, they're always all-wheel drive. So, and those have both been very competent vehicles to drive. And the same thing, it was sort of, I was back-to-back with two different pickup trucks, a Nissan Titan and a Toyota Tundra, both full-size pickup trucks. And most people, I think, my age would think, oh, when you think of pickup trucks, you think of Chevys and Fords. But there's a lot more than that now. Nissan makes a full-size, half-ton pickup truck. In fact, they even have one with a diesel engine in it. The Toyota Tundra makes a big pickup truck now, which has all kinds of towing capacity to it. So there's a lot of choices for people out there now. And different than when I first started to look at cars, you know, more than 30 years ago, it's really hard to say there's a terrible car out there. There are some that aren't designed as good as others, but cars today are so dependable and they work so well, which is why today the cars on the road are as old as they've ever been. They're somewhere between 11 and a half and almost 12 years old, the average car on the road.
Really?
Today.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. And I was going to ask you, I know back in the day, it was considered great if you could get 200,000 miles out of a car. Is that still the ballpark or are people pushing that?
People are pushing that. I have a coworker with a Honda Pilot, and I think her Pilot has 400,000 miles on it. And that's a little bit of an anomaly, but to the point where she actually gave it to her son, and she has another one that I think she has 150,000 on. The idea when I'll kind of tell you a little story. When I was a teenager, I remember there was a car in a parking lot, and there was a bunch of old people standing around it. So they were probably in their 30s when I was in my teens. And they had the hood up. And I kind of walked over and said, you know, what's going on? And the big story was this car had gone 70,000 miles and no one had done any work to the engine.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was a big deal because it was right. Not unusual that at 25 or 30,000 miles, you had to do some fairly major engine work. And then maybe at 100,000 miles, the engine was all worn out. And the idea that this I remember it was a Pontiac Bonneville, and this car had gone 70 or 80,000 miles, and the engine had never been apart. And that was really a big deal. And now we're seeing cars at used car lots, and they'll have 100,000 miles on it. And it'll be, well, this only has 100,000 miles on it because it's expected they'll go 200,000 or more with reasonable maintenance.
What is the difference?
A lot of it has to do with oil and gas. The oil and oil filters today are better than they've ever been. They lubricate better. And cars today have fuel injection as opposed to cars with carburetors. The fuel is metered more precisely, which doesn't tend to dilute the oil, so things stay lubricated better. The other thing is the machining process today, as the engines are being assembled, is so much better than it was.
So much more precise.
Yeah, 40 or 50 years ago. So
wow.
that has made a real difference. And people are, you talk to people today and they're not really great about maintenance. Sometimes they'll be, I think I changed the oil this year and they're not sure. Where when I first worked in a repair shop, we had people come in every 2,000 miles or so for an oil and filter change. Tune-ups were twice a year. And then, and even doing that kind of maintenance, people were not getting high mileage out of cars like they are today. So the manufacturing process has helped. And the way, again, oil and filters and all those kind of things. I mean, you talk about, I said something to somebody once about longevity of vehicles, and they said, well, people are living longer too. And I said, if you talk to a doctor, they'll say they're living longer because of blood pressure medication and cholesterol medication. And it's sort of like if you had to pick two things, and sort of with cars, you can kind of pick two things too. It's fuel and oil.
All right. Well, we're talking with John Paul, the Northeast Car Doctor for AAA. If you have questions about your car, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can also send a brief email tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We are in the middle of the height of summer driving season. We're between the 4th of July and Labor Day. This is when everything's happening in New England. John, we don't see overheated cars on the side of the road as often as we did before, but it still happens. How do you avoid that? And if it happens, what do you do?
Yeah, we don't see it like we used to, but you still see it. And one of the reasons that we still see it sometimes is because people aren't maintaining cooling systems as much as they used to, which is part of the problem. But still, it can happen, and you still have to look at those kind of things and say, well, you know, what can we do? And some of the basics that have been around for a long time, if you're driving down the road and the hot light comes on or you see the temperature gauge come on, it may sound a little counterintuitive, but shut the air conditioner off and turn the heat on, because that sort of helps with the cooling system of the engine, and it actually allows the system to expand a little bit, and that might help it cool down. The other thing you need to do is stop immediately. Older cars from the 60s and 70s, if they started to overheat, what would happen is they had a lot more heavy metal, cast iron, and they were a lot more forgiving. Today's engines, they're smaller, they're more powerful, but they're not as forgiving when it comes to overheating. So when you see any red light come on in a car, so if you see the red temperature light come on or the red engine light, oil light come on or red brake light come on, that really means that's immediate attention. You have to do something right away, and that's pull over as quickly, as long as you can do it safely. I mean, you don't want to stop in the middle of the highway, obviously, but you want to get over to the breakdown lane as soon as you can. If you have a temperature light that comes on and you say, yeah, it's only another 3 or 4 miles to drive home, you probably ruin the engine by the time you get home.
Wow, so, just 3 or 4
yeah,
miles.
Yeah.
So you said if you know, the light comes on to turn on the heat. So my lights come on, I've pulled over, I've turned on the heat. At that point, do I shut off the engine? Don't worry about the heat at that point.
No, but if you're sort of trying to get over there, turning on the heat, what happens in some cars, and not every car, but in some cars, the heater, the thing that keeps you warm in the wintertime, is turned off. So when you turn the heat on, it actually gets more of the engine coolant circulating through the engine. Even if it's constantly circulating, just having the fan blow across it helps take away some of that heat. And that's what you want to do. You want to take away some of the heat from the engine. But you still don't want to chance it. You don't want to drive very far. And you want to get over, shut it off. And the other thing you don't want to do, and a lot of people do it, is they go over and they don't really know anything. They open up the hood and they look at their radiator and they decide they're going to try to take the coolant cap off. And I don't know why they want to do that. And all that's going to happen is hot coolant's going to spray all over the place, and you're going to get hurt. So don't do that. Just let the car cool normally. And if you want to, you know, after it's cooled off for 45 minutes or so, if you want to start it up and see how it acts after that, and, you know, it may have been kind of a fluke. The other thing, if you are stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic, water boils at 212 degrees. The air coming out of the tailpipe of the car in front of you is 250 or 260 degrees.
Oh.
So if you're in bumper-to-bumper traffic, get some space between you and the cars in front of you, because why try to cool your engine off with hot air? So, you know, get
right,
the,
that makes
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, so that can make a difference.
Once you pulled over, should you lift the hood?
You can lift the hood. That's fine, because that's also a good signal to people that you've broken down. So lifting the hood, a good signal about emergency purposes, lets the engine cool, but don't leave the radiator alone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to go on a road trip, and what do we need to do? You know, you were talking about back when you were a kid, everybody had a checklist of what to do for the car before we went on that road trip. Is it the same checklist today?
No. And it's kind of funny, I wish I could find it. Someone years ago gave me an owner's manual for a Model T. So, you know, think, you know, early 1900s car. And it would say things like bring baling wire, a shovel. I don't know what you were supposed to do with the shovel exactly, but you were supposed to bring all these odd...
Maybe if you got stuck,
maybe if you got stuck. But all these odd things that you would never think about bringing with you today. But it's still a good idea to, think about your car and think about yourself at the same time. So it's, you know, have an extra quart of oil. Have windshield washer fluid with you. If you're driving in, kind of a time where there's a lot of bugs on the road, and you end up, you know, smearing all kinds of bugs all over the windshield or sap on the windshield, and your windshield washer goes dry, and now all of a sudden you can't see very well. So, you know, extra windshield washer. If you're comfortable doing it, a gallon of antifreeze and water mixed together. So if the car did overheat and you pulled over and you let it cool off, and then once it's cool, once the radiator is cool to the touch, if you decided to check it and add fluid to it then, that's fine. Still a good idea to bring jumper cables or a jump pack. Now they have these little, they're the size of a paperback book, and you can actually jump start a car with them. So you can kind of do it on your own if your battery went dead. The other thing is, you want to make sure that your spare tire is in good shape and that you have a jack and a lug wrench and all the tools necessary to change a flat tire if that's necessary to do that.
If your
car has a spare tire. At AAA, I think last time I looked, we have a list of about 130 vehicles that may not have a spare tire. They could have been as an option, but a lot of the small Hyundai Elantras didn't come with spares. A lot of the Chevy Cruzes didn't come with spares. There's a lot of cars that, and especially sports cars, don't come with spares. So you may find out there's no spare tire at all, which can be a problem depending on where you blow out a tire. If it's just a matter of you come out and those tires flat, they come with an air kit, so a little air compressor with some gooey stuff inside of it, and it pumps it up and it helps seal the tire up. But that's a very, very temporary repair. But if you hit a curb and you take a chunk out of the tire, there's no way that's going to work. And depending on where you are, you know, the bears are going to come and eat you.
Yeah, and you might not have cell service. I mean, so John, before we go to our first break, I want to ask you about something I don't think we've ever talked about on the program, which is sleepy driving. And we've all had that experience, especially on a longer road trip, mm-hmm. where we feel like, oh, gosh, we've got to pull over and have a little nap. And I'm wondering if there's sort of official guidance on when you know. I suspect that I've maybe a few times pushed it and waited a little too long. What do you say to folks who are about to take a road trip? How do you know when it's time to pull over for a little bit?
It's usually by the time you think it's time to pull over, you pass that time. So very similar to what happened with you. I'll give you a scary number. About 200,000 people a day fall asleep behind the wheel. Most of 200,000. And most of the time, it's just a quick nod. It's just, and then you kind of wake up and your adrenaline kicks in and you're, you know. But a couple things. If you are planning a long trip, don't drive when you typically sleep. So if you're kind of like, you know what, I'm going to leave at 2:00 in the morning because I want to get through New York traffic while it's quiet. Well, your body wants to sleep at that time. So you may find that you're able to do it for an hour or two, but by the time 4:00 in the morning rolls around, you're exhausted. So really what you want to do is you want to make sure you're well-rested to start off with. If you find yourself starting to kind of, you know, have trouble focusing, and it's funny, some technology in cars today will let you know that you're getting erratic. It'll actually flash up a picture of a coffee cup, and it'll say, time to take a break.
Huh?
Yeah, and what it does is it looks at speed and it looks at how you're holding the steering wheel, whether you're kind of, you know, not staying centered in the lane. And in some cases, it even looks at, you know, what your eyes and head are doing. So there's sophistication's there. But the best thing you can do, if you do find yourself very, very tired, pull over, get like a 20-minute nap in. Not any longer than that, because then you enter REM sleep, and then when you wake up, you tend to wake up groggy. So if you can do like a 20 to 30 minute catnap sort of thing, and then if you can get some caffeine in you, and better if you can get the caffeine in you before you take the nap, because it takes about 20 to 30 minutes for caffeine to affect your system. So if you had a cola or something with, you know, coffee or something with caffeine in it, you know, close your eyes for 20 minutes, get a little bit of sleep, woke up, do a little bit of exercise, so get a little bit of fresh air, walk around the car a little bit. Then that can get you maybe another few hours of alert driving, but there's no substitute for sleep, and that's the issue. It's just not there.
All right. Well, we do have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions for John Paul, the car doctor with AAA Northeast. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Hospice of Southern Maine. Calling hospice doesn't mean you're giving up. It means you're taking charge. Learn more at hospiceofsouthernmaine.org. And Conductor's Retreat at Madomic, presenting Tchaikovsky's Fifth in a free concert on Saturday, July 14th at 2. Details at conductorsretreat.org.
I'm Noelle King, host of Morning Edition. There's a long list of things we need in order to bring you Morning Edition every day. Let's see, there's the Grande Light No Foam Latte for David Green. Oh, wait, that's the wrong list. Our real list includes reporters and editors around the globe, analysts and satellites and producers. How can you help with that list? You can donate your old car to this station. We'll turn it into the programs you love.
And for more information, visit mainepublic.org and click on support.
I'm Bill Littlefield. 19 years ago, the sports anthem of a generation was released to the world.
I just remember it taking over. I mean, that's how big it got, where it wasn't just Little League backyards. It was at Fenway Park for the Major League Baseball All-Star Game.
The story behind Smash Mouth's 1999 hit All-Star. That's coming up this week on Only a Game. Join us.
And join us for Only a Game tomorrow morning at 7 a.m.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the latest on cars, trucks, and SUVs. Joining me, John Paul, who's AAA's Northeast Car Doctor. He's also a certified master technician and, as we just found out, president of the New England Motor Press Association. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with an email from CD. CD writes, "Does peppermint oil actually deter mice in cars? Is automotive wiring damage by mice still a problem?"
Not sure about peppermint oil. I've actually heard spearmint oil, but I don't know what the difference is between the two. But I have heard that that is in fact the case. You can take oil of peppermint or oil of spearmint, soak it, soak cotton balls in it, and that's supposed to help keep rodents away. You can actually buy these things. They look like little tea bags that are already pre-soaked and it smells pleasant. It's not like putting mothballs in a car, which I'm not sure even really works. To the point where, and one of the reasons that we're seeing more damage with rodents to wiring harnesses and other parts of cars is as car manufacturers have gotten more environmentally responsible, they're using less petroleum-based insulation for wires, and they've switched to a soy-based. Well, apparently soy tastes good, and petroleum-based wires didn't. So the mice tend to nibble on the wiring, to the point where actually Honda came out with a metal tape that you wrap around the wires on your car, and it's impregnated with capsium, that sort of red pepper stuff, and it's supposed to deter mice from eating your wires.
So the second part of CD's question was, are mice and wires still a problem? And you would say they're more of a problem than they used to be.
They're more of a problem than they used to be. Years ago, it was one of those things that if you left a car, an old car parked in a barn, you might come out and there'd be, you know, a mouse house in the car. But today they're actually eating wiring, where before they might have, you know, burrowed into the seat or something. But now they're actually nibbling on the wiring. And I have seen literally thousands and thousands of dollars worth of damage done to a car because of some sort of rodent, and to the point where one person I talked to, their insurance company was actually going to total the car because it wasn't, I think it was a $4,000 or $5,000 car, and to properly repair it, it was going to be $3,500 or $4,000 to repair all the wiring damage that was done. And the insurance company just said, you know what, it isn't worth us to do it. So it still is a problem. And if you suspect you have that kind of problem, sometimes you're causing it. If you're a nice person and you feed birds or something like that, the mice are going to want to come into your garage or your barn to get the bird seed, or you have pet food out there, something like that. So you want to try to remove anything. If you have kids in your car and there's Cheerios and Goldfish in your car, it's another reason that Mice can be attracted to the car, and then while they're there, they can do some damage. So you have to be a little bit careful. And as you know, more and more building happens, there's less places for critters to go. Buy a cat.
Or go to Scott, who's calling from Sebago. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hey, Scott.
Thanks for taking my call. And my question is, I got a 2005 Toyota RAV4 with 220,000 miles, just get broken in. And in between oil changes, which we try to do every 3,000, notice that I'm down a quart. Is there a additive or go to a thicker oil to prolong it? Or just keep adding oil between oil changes?
No, if you're changing oil every 3,000 miles and at 1,500 miles you're adding a quart, I wouldn't worry anything about it. That's sort of normal wear and tear. A little bit of oil consumption at 200,000 miles is perfectly normal. I wouldn't worry about it. To repair it, now, providing there's nothing leaking, and I assume that you've kind of looked for that kind of problem, or your garage has looked for that problem. As long as there's nothing that's just leaking, out from under the car, it's probably just a little bit of wear. It's a little bit of piston wear, maybe even a little bit of valve guide wear. But at that kind of mileage, it's not really worth taking the engine apart to do any major repairs. So for the price of a quart of oil in between oil changes, that's all I would do. As far as any kind of magic additive, the kind of mechanic in a can sort of thing, most of them promise a lot and deliver very little. So I'm always pretty skeptical with that sort of stuff. So I don't think I'd bother. I think I just plan on, every 1,000 miles or so, pull the dipstick and see where the oil level is. And if it's down a quart, put a quart in.
And going to a thicker oil, viscosity oil, would that help? Or
It may cut down on the oil consumption slightly. But I'm a big believer and try to stay whatever the manufacturer, recommends. Today's engine's different than a bunch of years ago, where you could run, literally you could run 20W50 oil in almost anything and not worry about it. Today, the oil passages are so fine and the oil has to be so thin on startup that running a thicker weight oil could be a problem. So if your RAV4 says use 1030, I would stay with the 1030 and not go down, go up any higher than that.
Scott, right. Thanks for your call. Good luck. We'll go to an email from Mimi. I love my 06 Prius, but must prepare for its replacement. I'm looking for a hatchback, five-door, gearless, excellent miles per gallon. I last drove out of state in 2014 and only occasionally drive as far as Scudic Point or Portland. My son assures me that some sort of plug-in would suit me and my needs. Any recommendations?
Well, there is a lot, and there's a lot of choices, and the choices go from, there's no such thing as an inexpensive car, but you can get a plug-in hybrid at you could get a Prius that's a plug-in hybrid for that matter, Prius Prime. To if you're looking for something a little bit bigger, the RAV4 hybrid, If you're a AAA member, go into any one of our AAA offices up here, AAA Northeast, and ask for the Green Car Guide. It's free to AAA members. It's got all the information about all the different cars, hybrids, plug-in hybrids, and for people that can't find something in between, the most fuel efficient of a particular vehicle. So it might be a pickup truck. What's the most fuel efficient of that particular pickup truck? Pick it up, kind of peruse it, see what you want to get, and that's going to help.
Does the guide include used cars?
It does not.
Okay. Because I've seen that there's some, you can get a really good deal, for example, on a Nissan Leaf that's a few years old.
There are, because the new Nissan Leaf is so good on top of that. And it's kind of funny. It's one of those things, too, that the Nissan Leaf, when it came out, it got about 90 miles per charge, and the batteries last about 10 years. So you have to be a little bit wary. It's kind of interesting. If you go to trade in a 5-year-old Nissan Leaf, the dealer will say, we can't give you much because it's 5 years old. If you go to buy a 5-year-old Nissan Leaf, the dealer says, look, it's only 5 years old. So,
I think with all sorts of cars, that's a conversation that happens.
Yeah. So there are some good choices out there. Certainly, in the new car side, I'm a fan of the Toyota RAV4 hybrid. I think it's, It's one of the more powerful versions of the hybrid, and it's also the most fuel efficient. So it kind of it. I remember when I drove it when it first came out. I kind of came away with it afterwards and said, "This is a car that I really buy. This really it does everything I want it to do, and it gets good gas mileage, and I'm cheap." So it.
So the I'm sorry. Did you say the hybrid?
The hybrid RAV4.
The hybrid is so it gets better mileage than like a Prius.
It doesn't get better mileage than a Prius, but it gets better mileage than a regular RAV4. You know,
right.
Even in its most economical trim. So it's
I see.
Yeah. So and then there's also the New England Motor Press just gave a award to the Mitsubishi Outlander, which is a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. So it's a car that could actually fit her needs pretty well because you can plug it and charge it up. And if you drive very locally, probably have it never run on gasoline. So that would be another one to look at is the plug-in hybrid version of the Mitsubishi Outlander.
And a similar question from Nancy on Facebook. I'm looking for advice on buying or leasing an electric car for use in Maine. My commute is short, but I'd like at least 200 miles battery for the days I'm traveling. So who has that kind of range?
That's pretty limited. You're going to be limited with either a Tesla or a Chevrolet Bolt. So not a Volt, but a Bolt with a B. And that will give you a little bit over 200, and I think it's about 230 miles. It's a pretty unique little car. It's kind of a hatchback sort of thing. So pretty handy. It's nice to be able to think that you can be, you know, gas-free for the rest of your life, but you also have to have those limitations of you are going to have to charge up. Charging up is best done using a dedicated charging station. The idea of trying to charge up with a regular household outlet is almost impossible. It takes
for the Bolt.
Yeah, for almost any electric car, really, because I know I drove a Kia Soul electric car. It had a range of about 110 miles, and my commute to work is almost that. So I brought it home and I plugged it into an outside outlet, and it took almost 2 days to fully recharge.
Oh, so it's not the. I know people who do the overnight.
Right.
They plug their car in and go in the morning, but that didn't work for that car.
That, not on a 110 volt outlet. Some people have actually gone to putting dedicated charging stations in their house. So, and you don't necessarily have to. It's kind of the same plug that is that runs an electric dryer. So, and that will charge up the car more in 4 or 5 hours than a regular outlet.
So a special outlet, but not something exorbitantly expensive to have installed.
No, if you wanted to put a dedicated charging station in a lot of cases, there's tax incentives to do it, so it actually helps. And it looks sort of like the ones you see, out in front of municipal buildings and things. But you don't necessarily have to do that.
Okay, and on the same topic, and then we'll move on. Bob on Facebook says, looking at my next car after my 200,000-plus Prius dies and looking forward to this event, the electric vehicle ride and drive in South Portland, July 17th. Again, the electric vehicle ride and drive in South Portland on July 17th. So we'll put a link to more information about that on our Facebook page and web page. We'll go now to Steve, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. Steve, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Oh, now I can. Go ahead, Steve.
This is perfect timing. I just got back from the garage. I brought my 2007 Honda Civic in. It has 180,000 miles on it, and it needs $1,500 worth of repairs, new air conditioner, compressor, and a new water pump. So I'm thinking about getting rid of it and buying another secondhand car. So should I hang on to it, put the money into it, or get rid of it?
Steve, how is the rest of the car?
Well, the clear coat is peeling like a bad sunburn.
Yeah.
So cosmetically, it looks terrible. I've been told that the back brake drums are pretty rusted and may need to be replaced. And the local high school said they could do it for me for just about $300.
Well,
so it's got needs a lot of work.
Well, and that's what you have to look at. If you're looking at, say, you're looking at $2,000 worth of repairs, or maybe even a little bit more than that. And you said it was what year, 2007?
2007. Yeah. Blue books were about $2,000 to $3,000.
Right. And what happens is when you start to look at putting more than 50% of the value into the car based on the repair costs, it's not necessarily a very good investment. But on the other hand, if you, you know, what is your, you know, you say your car's book value is worth $2,000 or $3,000.
Yeah,
yeah, but is it really? Could you find somebody to buy it? And on the other hand, could you spend a couple thousand dollars and be able to drive the car another couple of years? Maybe. So what I would do, what I would do based on everything you told me so far, I might ask the garage to take one more look at just the overall condition of the car and see if they can predict a little bit, just to say, hey, is the exhaust system going to fall off of it? Is the rear main seal leaking? Are the belts bad? Is the radiator hose, you know, radiator starting to leak? And kind of give you a real feel for what maybe the next couple of years worth of repairs are going to be like. If they can come up with that and it's still only, you know, a couple thousand dollars to repair it, even though I said, you know, if it doesn't make sense to put more than half the value of the car into the repairs, it still is always cheaper to fix an old car than buy a new one. And even if that new one's a used one, you know, if you're going to go out and buy another Honda Civic, you're probably going to want something a little bit newer. You're going to pay $8,000 or $9,000 or $10,000 for it. And you kind of look at that and you go, well, if I put a couple thousand dollars into mine and I can drive it for a couple more years, it might be worth doing it. But I would have it professionally checked out one more time, just to see if there's what more that could be wrong with it to really make the, really make an informed decision.
Well, Steve, good luck. And thanks for your question, because this is a question we all will face at some point in our car's life. So I really appreciate it. We do have to go to another break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Patriot Subaru, providing sales service and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco.
A small island off the coast of Maine may become the model for energy infrastructure around the country.
It's more reliable, it's more robust, it's resilient. Failures are isolated.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll visit Isle Oho to take a look. Plus, as recreational marijuana is legalized in Massachusetts, growers think about how to go green.
We're trying to figure out what is the absolute most efficient way to grow cannabis.
Please join us.
And you can join us for Next at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling.
Hi, it's Kyle Risdahl, the host of Marketplace. My very first car was a 1971 Cutlass 442 convertible. It was red, it had a white convertible top, it went about 1,000 miles an hour in a straight line. Man, I loved that car. Sadly, I grew up, and now I drive a minivan. Turn your car into the programs you love. Here's how.
Visit mainpublic.org and click on support for more information.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, automotive advice. Joining me in the studio, John Paul with AAA Northeast. He is the car doctor. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Diane calling from Porter, Maine. Hi, Diane. Go ahead.
Hi. You caught me eating a snack. I'm sorry. I have a Chevy Bolt I just got, and I love it. And I charged it for, 3 weeks on my household current before we were able to get the 240-volt installed. And it was very long, but it worked. And we live out on the New Hampshire line in Porter, so it's about 45 miles to go to Portland, which is usually our longest trip. But I can travel around here for a long time without charging it up.
The Chevrolet Bolt is just it. They did a really good job with it, and they did a really good job trying to put a lot of technology in a car that's, you know, not that big. And and it does charge up. Yeah, the convenience outlet, the idea of plugging into a household outlet is a bit of a stretch. But once you put the heavy duty charging system in, and then you're able to charge up, 4 to 6 hours maybe.
Yeah.
And then you have your full range, and you're not going to the gas station. But just to let you know, one of these days, the state's going to catch up with you and say, you know, we got to start taxing people with electric cars, because, you know, the gasoline people pay car tax or gas tax.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, Diane, thanks for your call. And thanks for sharing. We'll move on to Michelle, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead.
Hi. I have an 18-year-old daughter who is going to college in Farmington in the fall, and we're looking to gather resources to get her an affordable car. Our budget is like between $5,000 and $8,000, and we know it's going to have a lot of miles on it, but we want something that's safe. Is all that possible?
Yeah, you just have to buy her something she absolutely doesn't want, which is, you know, it's going to be used to that.
So is your theory, it'd be buy her an ugly car so she won't want to drive and therefore she'll be safe?
Well, that's part of it. She'll be less likely to take her friends because they don't want to go out in it. You want to look at kind of a nice conservative four-door sedan sort of thing, maybe, or maybe even a small SUV could be a good choice. Fuel economy would not be a primary concern, and sportiness certainly wouldn't be any concern. So I would try
That's okay. She's actually a pretty practical driver, and we understand that. I want it to be safe for her to get from Brunswick to Farmington, like in the winter.
Yeah, you might, and you're going to have to look long and hard, but you might find a good used Subaru that's going to get reasonably good gas mileage. It's going to be all-wheel drive. And it's going to give you that little bit of an edge in the wintertime, a little bit extra traction. They do well in crash testing. If you're looking, though, look at all the different places where you can get safety information, IIHS, the Insurance Institute of Highway Safety. You can look and see how that car did on crash testing. Same thing with NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. You can look there. You can also look, if you're looking at private party cars, you can get the serial number, the vehicle identification number, and run it through the National Highway Traffic Safety website and see if there were recalls and see if those recalls have been performed on the car. Just good information to know. And the other thing, and I always advise people to do this, if you do find a car and it looks good, still bring it to a repair shop. Let them check it over and make sure there's everything's good with the car, because you want to make sure the car is safe. And, you know, sometimes what can happen, depending where you buy the car, it can look good, but maybe it's been kind of patched back together and it could be a safety issue somewhere down the road. So, but you can definitely do it.
Last week, and the car broke down on the way back from after just being cleared by the garage.
Oh, my.
You might want to look for another garage then.
Yeah. 100,000 miles on Subarus that are in that price range, is that something worth looking at? Or at what point do we not look at a Subaru that's got too many miles on it?
You know, once they start at 150,000, 160,000 miles, I'd probably start to shy away from, unless you find one that you really know the service records and has been very well maintained. I was talking to somebody who just bought a Subaru recently. It had 120,000 miles on it, and he thought nothing of driving it back and forth to Florida because the car was so well maintained. So a little bit of the history of the car is always good to know, too.
All right, Michelle, good luck and congratulations to your daughter. An email here from Vic. I'm considering trading a 2012 Forester for a new version and heard that the 2019 will have some major changes. Your thoughts about waiting for those versus a 2018 model?
If we can only put him together with our previous caller, we'd be all set. They'd have the Forester, they'd be all good. The new Forester, it's built on a newer, lighter weight chassis, which makes it more fuel efficient. They're putting more of their EyeSight safety technology into the car. They're using a smaller 2-liter engine that's more fuel efficient. So the cars are essentially, Subaru's a Subaru kind of thing. It's still going to be all-wheel drive. It's still going to have a four-cylinder, what they call a flat four-cylinder engine in it. So they're still going to be the same, but they've done a lot with this new platform, and that's sort of how they build cars now, is they start with a base and then kind of build a car around it. The newest Forester is built on this new platform that that Subaru has been starting to use in the last year or so. So it's certainly going to be worth looking at. I remember when Foresters were sort of small vehicles. Now they're getting kind of big. They're getting kind of almost mid-size SUV-ish. So
if it were you, would you wait?
Yes, I think
okay.
I would.
Anne on Facebook says, speaking of taking a break to sleep on a long drive, I have a hard time finding a safe place to stop and sleep. Even designated rest areas seem sinister in the dark. Suggestions?
Yeah, good point. I don't know that I have a really good answer for that, other than, you know, maybe, you know, if you are on a long trip and you can kind of plan a little bit that, you know, I'll, you know, maybe I can pull into a fire station parking lot or a police station parking lot to take a little bit of a nap. The best thing is really is, you know, plan your trip to the point. If you're going to be driving cross country, try to plan your drive so, you know, when it's time for you to take a rest, you're going to be at a hotel somewhere would be the thing to do. But you're right. A rest area at 2 o'clock in the morning. They all look a little sinister. Sinister is the right word, I think. So.
All right. We'll go to Carol, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Carol. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I have a 2006 cylinder Honda Accord with 125,000 miles on it. It has been a great car, always taken good care of it. But I wonder whether just because of its age, I should think about getting a new car just because of the safety features that cars have now. I mean, it does have side airbags, but other than that, it doesn't have all the bells and whistles of what a car would have now.
Well, your car has side airbags. It has anti-lock brakes. It may have traction control. But you're right. It doesn't have things like lane departure warning. It doesn't have blind spot monitors. It doesn't have cross traffic alert, which is the backup sensors that can sense if somebody's coming up an aisle in a parking lot. And if those things are important to you and you want to replace a car that's essentially 18, going on 19 years old now, really, because the new model years will be coming out in just a couple of months, you know, those are certainly things you can look at. You know, as much as I like the new technology, there are times where I look at it and go, it's good, but it's still not perfect yet. And it's sort of like with, you know, people ask me about how long till self-driving vehicles come out. It's going to be a while. And, you know, this new technology, it can help, but still there's no substitute for a well-engaged driver. So you may find that if you went out and bought a 2019 Honda Accord when they come out, that it's certainly a lot newer and a lot nicer than your 2000, but is it that much safer? Well, it's going to have more technology in it, but it depends on you and, you know, everyone else around you. So,
lots to think about. Good luck, Carol. We're going to go to Dee, who's calling from New Hampshire. Hi, Dee. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a Honda Civic. It's a 2013. I haven't been using it for a couple weeks. And my husband went to take it out for a run just to, you know, get some gas and oil moving through it. And it is stuck in the emergency brake. He can't back it up. And one of the wheels is dragging. Is there a trick that we can get it out of that emergency brake?
No, not really. It's for one reason or another, and I don't know why it would be, is the emergency brake rusted in place. And even though you don't think things should rust this time of year, you think that more in the wintertime when there's salt on the roads. But it is possible. And short of crawling under the car and looking for the emergency brake cables and kind of wiggling them around and shaking them, you could try going back and forth just a little bit. So go pull forward, step on the brake, back up, step on the brake, pull forward, use the emergency brake, back up, use the emergency brake. It may free it up just enough, but chances are it's not going to free it up completely. It's going to drag a little bit, and then if you go to drive it, it's going to overheat that brake anyway. My suggestion would be have it towed to a repair shop.
All right. Well, good luck, Dee. And Dee's going to be the last call this hour. I apologize to everybody left hanging. You're popular, John. And John Paul, thank you so much, as always, for joining us. John Paul, AAA Northeast Car Doctor, also an ASC Certified Master Technician, also the president of the New England Motor Press Association. John Keimel ran the board today. You can find all sorts of things on our website, past editions of Maine Calling. You can listen to prior shows. That's mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 7. We need to let you know, Mike Jandreau wrote our theme song, our new theme song. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.